higher performance, and faster and more reliable.
Welcome to Open Paddock, episode 239 for Tuesday, July 8th, 2014. Tonight on the show, in the miscellaneous portion of the show, we're going to talk a little bit about F1 at Silverstone, unionization in NASCAR, and Sage Karam flirting with 10 tops. A little bit of Formula E first full test info as well. Jumping into the IndyCar section of the podcast, we will talk about Pocono, a little bit about Dallara fixing their suspension going forward for Toronto, and other IndyCar news. Road to Indy information. Chavez dominated the handful of competitors at Pocono. We will talk about that, and Doug will rant. And in the rally section of the podcast tonight, Mike Shaw will take us through the WRC news and a brief recap of the Goodwood Festival of Speed. This is Open Paddock. Well, good evening, everyone. It's good to have everybody back together for the podcast this week, since John and I kind of towed the line last week and took care of everybody's dirty work. Let's do the roll call. I'm Mike Weitzel. I will be your host this evening, and I am drinking something from Mr. Shaw's state. It's a Deschutes Twilight Summer Ale. Very tasty.
Oh, does it sparkle?
I might have to try this one.
Not my normal fare, but I had a cooler full of beers I wouldn't drink this weekend normally to support family that was in for a get together. And well, I've got some term, leftovers.
The end of the term, light.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it's not terribly light.
Drink. Pour it out. My thought is, okay, I'm getting some product name light. It doesn't matter what the prefix is, so long as the last part is light, they'll drink it. And I'm just like,
well, that's true. Well, you know, the other girly beer I have in my fridge is it's from a local brewery in Cleveland. It's Fathead's Bumbleberry, which is a blueberry and honey ale, which isn't too bad.
It's light and fruity.
Yeah. So,
fruit and beer is just, you know, usually it doesn't do well with me, but there's times it does work. So,
well, over the weekend, I had a tangerine wheat that was quite good. Oh, well,
you know, with a wheat beer, maybe.
Yeah,
that could work.
Anyway, moving on from me, because you're hearing all the other likely suspects, I'll go with J. Douglas Patterson. Welcome to the show. And what are you drinking?
Thank you. Thank you. I am enjoying a fine couple of pints of Harp. And enjoying them in my lovely Pilsner glass Kansas Rally Weekend 2012 trophy for Ooh, our victory.
Look at that.
So, yeah. Gotta love a trophy you can drink from.
Definitely.
Well, that describes any trophy for Kimmy.
That's true.
Anyway.
Mike, not anymore. I don't know
even,
if he'll be
even
drinking.
The big plate, he'll treat it just like a saucer.
Lap it up.
Nice. So, Mike Shaw, you hear his melodious tones in the background. Mike, what are you drinking this evening?
Tonight I got myself a nice dry martini, aviation gin. Good stuff.
Very cool. Very dry with that that waft of vermouth.
Right, just kind of waved it over.
Kind of
set
the bottle next to the glass. And
right, exactly.
And Mr. John C. Olsikowski, I know you're drinking tonight because I heard you talk about that in the pre-show. What's suiting your fancy?
Well, Shiner is my local go-to, and enjoying a light blonde from them. It's actually quite tasty, especially considering they're pimping it as a light beer.
Lots of light beer on the show tonight. I guess we can work with it, you know. This Twilight Ale is going down fast, and I'm going to have to replace it here soon. And I'm trying to figure out if I'm going to switch out for my Rye India Pale Ale, or if I'm going to switch over and just choke down the Bumbleberry. Well, opening up the show tonight, we're going to talk about our miscellaneous section of the show. Last week we gave it a crazy name. This week we have a new one. We will call it the unintelligible amalgamation of motorsports musings, or the segment of the show. Amalgamation, sort of like America, you know, get that
America.
I'm saying thank you. I think to Doug for that one.
No, that would be me.
Oh, yeah, it was John.
Well, it was John's. Yeah, that was John, inspired by my desperate act to try to upload last.
Yes. Sorry about the podcast last week. We got it in the feed, and that was halfway there. And this week, Doug had to re-upload it from a Wi-Fi at McDonald's. So thank you.
Well, you know, the nice thing is, you know, we can only really take an hour of you guys at a time. So, you know,
yeah.
Having that little bit of a break was not a bad thing.
Probably. Well, let's jump right into miscellaneous. As we have talked about, F1 has been relegated to the start of the show, where we talk about all kinds of stuff, and we will breeze through F1 as it were. F1 was at Silverstone, the traditional home of Grand Prix racing, it seems these days, because everyone's based in the UK and there's no race in France. So first thing to note is qualifying for the weekend was a bit crazy because there were changeable conditions throughout qualifying. Those changeable conditions caught out both Ferraris and both Williams in Q1 because they decided not to put in a banker lap, and then all hell broke loose from the skies. So they were caught out in Q1. But more interesting even than that is what happened in Q3, where Nico Rosberg and Sebastian Vettel and Jenson Button and Nico Hülkenberg and Kevin Magnussen all put in a quick lap on slick tires as it started to rain during the session. At the end of the session, they all held it in, put those laps in, and Lewis Hamilton opted to pull off the track instead. Lewis ended up qualifying sixth, Nico qualified first, Sebastian Vettel second, and Jenson Button third. Quite a bit of drama there for qualifying. But
the qualifying was actually rather interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I tuned into it the changing conditions with the rain was marvelous. Who would have thought that last stint, even Matchett himself is going, what is Vettel waiting for that last lap for? It's not getting any better. And they show this shot of just it's dumping in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. Right. And then he goes out for that last shot, and what do you know?
Oh.
Turned out pretty good for him.
I loved the post-qualifying interview with Hamilton afterward. I really don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here's...
Thought he had it in the bag, that's why.
In the week leading up to the race, he kept comparing himself to Muhammad Ali, and I guess he was, you know, just hanging on the ropes, waiting for his time.
I am the greatest! Oh, please tell me that that someone was there to do the Howard Cosell impersonation.
Yeah.
I mean, surely someone could have gotten Rich... Oh, wait, no, they couldn't have gotten Rich Little.
Now, the start of the race also had a little bit of drama. Fernando Alonso ended up lining up in an incorrect pit position and was thus fined 5 seconds stop and go on his first pit stop. So that kind of put him back a little bit. But the biggest problem...
Let's be clear. This was not a slight little infraction.
Yeah.
Half of his car was out of the starting grid.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, the penalty was deserved. But why did they take so long for any penalty for that to be announced, especially when it was when he was so obviously out of his grid position?
Yeah, that's certainly an odd one. I mean, yeah, clearly he's out of grid position. He said he was trying to get it in reverse before the lights came on, but
after the Kimi red flag, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're right, because it was on the restart, wasn't it?
Yep, it was on the restart.
Okay, so let's talk about the Kimi red flag. Kimi went off the track, tried to rejoin at high rates of speed, hit some pretty odd pavement as he came back onto the track. Car went all squirrely, put him right into the wall, and also collected a few people along the way. Felipe Massa did some pretty masterful driving to avoid some potential calamity. And Max Chilton almost had his head taken off by Kimi's tire.
I was going to say, there were parts flying like shotgun projectiles. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
That was a hard hit. And yeah, lots of shards going everywhere.
Yeah, Kimmy was held out of Silverstone testing this week, recovering from this accident. I don't think I ever heard exactly what was injured on him other than just being shaken up immensely.
Bruised ankle,
okay. Yeah, big deal because they had to red flag the race, and the red flag period lasted for over an hour. As they repaired the, you know, side of, you know, the wall that he ran into and everything of that nature. So, whew, don't see that in F1 very often.
Where he crossed over. Actually, one of the things that I found most interesting was actually something that what's his name, who's walking around in the pits, was saying, is that they talk about how they have these nice big safe runoff areas, you know, for mm-hmm. F1s. They all redesigned all these tracks to be safer. But it also gives these guys an opportunity to go off and at a high rate of speed come back on and do something stupid like that. So Maybe they should rethink some of that and, you know, maybe make it more of just a gravel trap. Look, you know, you go off course, you're stuck.
What played into this for Kimi is there's apparently a drainage trench. However,
but he crossed over in the grass. So
right. Well, the drainage trench runs through the grass. But when he was coming back on, he crossed over that trench, basically like crossing a small ditch, if you were. Mm-hmm. And they think that they speculated that was what damaged his suspension, so that when he did come back on, he had no ability to control the car anyway. So
right. Yeah, definitely. But if he would have slowed it down a bit, there was a section of pure pavement where he could have rejoined, but he cut across where that grass was. So it was avoidable for him to not cross over the grass there, but
right.
He chose to take the shortest route, and had a consequence.
And beyond that, you know, his rejoining of the track was dangerous. That's just all there is to it. He chose mm-hmm. to keep his foot in it and try and keep his pace up, and he endangered other drivers because of it. Yep. And I kind of wonder why the FIA didn't take that opportunity to penalize, to set a standard for it. But such is the musings of the FIA. They make little sense at times. But then again, it's up to the stewards at the event to adjudicate these things, and sometimes the FIA has no say, per se. Now, that leads us a little bit into some later race things, as, you know, Sebastian Vettel and Alonso were duking it out. I guess it was a pretty, pretty tense battle for several laps as Vettel and Alonso were vying for fifth and sixth. Vettel came out the victor on it, but not before whinging over the radio at Alonso and Alonso whinging back at Vettel for, you know, supposedly infringing upon the track limits, which they said that they were going to very harshly penalize if people exceeded the track limits this weekend. And, well, they didn't. It's interesting to see this because this was good racing and everybody loved this good racing, and the FIA did the right thing by swallowing the whistle on this good racing. But before the race, they're telling everybody we're going to be harsh on this. I guess the funniest part of it is Vettel's comments about Alonso after the race. He basically was saying Alonso likes to complain. You know, this is I can't remember exactly his exact comments on it, but he was teasing Alonso for complaining too much when he was doing the exact same thing and hasn't stopped complaining all season. After the race, they asked Alonso about the battle, and Alonso said, yeah, kind of fun battle. I enjoyed the battle. It was good to race with him like that. But the fact of the matter is, we're talking about fifth and sixth. This is not where either of us should be racing. So taking a little higher road than Vettel did during his comments. John, what were you going to say?
Alonso was, I saw he was quoted in another article as saying that he knew that Vettel was going to be able to get around him. You know, but that's his job to mm-hmm. try to prevent him from getting around, and he did his job. So
absolutely,
it was great. It was great on TV, that's for sure. I love it.
Great fight, yeah.
I seem to recall many years ago when Alonso was driving for Renault, and he was being tailed by one Michael Schumacher at the San Marino Grand Prix in the closing stages of the race, and he was able to keep Schumacher behind him, and it was one of the best drives I'd seen in a very long time at that point. And it really raised his stock at that point in his career. That's what you are trained to do. That is what you must do as a driver. So anyway, not much to see there. Let's move on. Hamilton secured a crucial victory at Silverstone because he was making so much noise in the press that he really had to back up his words with actual actions. Though his actions, I guess, it's great. He got 25 points in the championship, but Nico Rosberg had his own issues, had gearbox trouble that he was phoning into the team about quite a bit during the race, ended up retiring because of said gearbox issues, and handed the points over to Alonso because they were clearly the class of the field this weekend. Lewis Hamilton ended up finishing the race a massive 30 seconds ahead of Valtteri Bottas in the Williams. So great result for Valtteri, being the only Finnish driver who had a clear head about him instead of trying to destroy everybody else's race by keeping the foot in it when you're off the track. But, you know, Daniel Ricciardo ended up finishing third ahead of his teammate Sebastian Vettel, who finished fifth, even though Sebastian Vettel qualified much better than Daniel Ricciardo did. This is an ongoing theme, and it's not getting any better for the past champion.
No, not at all. But I still have to question how much of it is just that magical combination of driver and car. It's not, well, Red Bull is underperforming anyway, but, you know, that combination is closer to perfect with Ricciardo and the current Red Bull than it is with Vettel.
Yeah, indeed. Though Ricciardo was third, he was 46 seconds shy of the leader, Lewis Hamilton. He was in a battle with Jenson Button at the end of the race, but was still well ahead of him across the line. Not really worth talking about a whole lot more on that. The points championship, though, leans Nico Rosberg's way only by 4 points at this juncture of the season, where 165 points for Rosberg, 161 for Hamilton, and Daniel Ricciardo was at 98. This is the first time Daniel has been ahead of Alonso in the championship. This is a big deal. Ricciardo coming in his rookie season, he is doing very well ahead of his teammate by 28 points. So very good deal for him. You know, the couple of brief notes in Formula One. One of the things that we've been harping on in Formula One is the changing of the engine regulations. The engines are frozen. Well, they're in this current development cycle of the engines for the next 7 years. And the funny thing about it, you know, we're in the first of 7 years this year. And we've been talking about how little development they actually get to do in the upcoming off season. And here's what they get to do. They allot points to different parts of the engine and powertrain for the car. There's a total of 66 points allotted to the different sections of the car. Each of these different things, like say, if you want to work on valve train, or if you want to work on crankshaft or something like that, let's say you want to if you want to work on a crankshaft, it might be listed as worth 2 points in the allotment. Or if you want to work on spark plugs, it might be listed as 1 point. You might want to work on the MGUK, a certain section of that might be worth 3 points. So depending on what you want to work on in the engine itself, there are 66 points allotted to the total engine, and you can, in your off-season, work on 32 points of that engine in the upcoming off season. So you can't work on the whole thing. You can only work on parts of it, and you go through and designate what parts you're going to change. So for this first off season, you have 32 points that you can work on. The next off season will be 15 points. The next off season will be less, and year on year, you will have less that you can work on. And we've talked about how with Honda coming in next year, there's the potential that they come in, they can work on all 66 points of the engine. That makes it potentially beneficial for them to come in with a clean sheet of paper, whereas everybody else has to start with what they've already got and tweak what worked, tweaked what didn't work, and only in very limited areas. So I hope I made sense of that for everybody.
So I do have a question.
Yes.
If one of the engine manufacturers shares their engine development on Facebook, do they get like bonus tokens?
Ooh, that's a good idea. Maybe the fans can tweet in who they want to have more engine development tokens.
Great. My game invites are going to go through the roof.
Nice.
Nice.
Well, I think it's a good way to go about it, but there's only so much that you can... that you can work on. But the problem still is, you get ahead, you're going to stay ahead, because Mercedes gets to work on 32 points of their engine. You get to work on 32 points of your engine. Their 32 points are already stronger than your 32 points.
Understanding how at least the basics of the internal combustion engine, if you're going to work on something like a piston, for example, if you change that piston, there are other parts that are either directly connected or indirectly affected by the changes that you make to that piston. So just the piston change could cascade into changes to connecting rods and crankshaft and balancing and who knows what other components may need to be affected just by, changing that one. It seems somewhat restrictive with this system that, there's only so much you're going to be able to do within that allotment. And I understand that that's the goal, but if you have a legitimate piece of development, you're forced to sacrifice potentially another lucrative bit of development in another area simply because you don't have enough engine points or development points to be able to play.
Yeah. Oh, it is what it is. Speaking of things in F1 that make us a little bit concerned, Pirelli's revealed images of what they're going to be testing. It's an 18-inch Formula One tire with a low-profile look to it. Instead of the big balloon tires that they're running this year, it's a thin tire, kind of like, you see on the ghetto rides. Not sure exactly how this qualifies as road relevant, but I guess some people drive around in cars with tires like that. Here's the problem with these tires that they're going to be testing. Really, it's only for aesthetics, because they're going to be testing, like I said, at Silverstone with this tomorrow, Wednesday. Here's the problem. You're not going to get any relevant data. It's just to go around and get pictures of what the tires look like on the car. So why even take it out on the track? Because here's the deal. This tire does not work with the current suspension at all. The current suspension on the cars are very stiff because the tire absorbs so much of your forces. So this thin-walled tire doesn't do that at all.
I don't even like the look of it, but I understand what they're trying to do as far as being relevant. You buy a new car today, it's going to have 16, 17, 18-inch wheels on it. So it translates at least to,
Well, and it's not just the tire. It's not just the wheel diameter. It's the profile of the sidewall.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at the Formula One cars now, and it looks like they're running on giant freaking balloons. I mean, it looks cartoonish to me. When I see, all the other, all the other cars I see on the road, when I look at sports car racing, for example, and as you said, if you go buy a modern car, my Fiesta came with 40 series tires. I mean, it's that you have the rim and they painted some rubber on the outside of it. this is a good move, I think, thinking of moving to a more modern tire wheel pairing.
Yeah.
But I agree with you, Mr. Weitzel, that any data that you get from this is completely irrelevant. Yeah. This is an aesthetics test only. Although I do think it's a good direction.
It may be a good direction, but this is going to necessitate a wholesale change to the suspension next year, complete redesign. So we'll be interesting to see this going forward and see if...
But we're trying to cut costs.
Yeah, indeed. Trying to cut costs. Everyone should be cheaper. for Ferrari because Caterham won't be there. Oh yeah, Caterham. Yes, they have sold. They're completely owned by somebody else, and Colin Coles is going to be involved with the Caterham effort. If you recall, Colin Coles is one of the guys who is trying to start a different F1 team. We're still kind of waiting to hear what happened with that other Formula, I can't remember what, a Formula Rosa or whatever it was that he was trying to start. But the only other thing to note this evening in F1, we will try and get you moving through the rest of the show forthrightly. The FIA is set to ban the front and rear interconnected suspension systems that almost everybody is using this year. The governing body wrote to the teams on Tuesday to tell them that their detailed investigations into the design of these interconnected suspension systems, they believe they're in contravention of the rules.
Well, specifically the movable aero catch-all rule, which I think is just laughable. Anytime they can't find an excuse to ban something, they always fall back on the movable aero thing. This is how they got rid of the J damper, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, stuck in goo.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And those are so fun. You know, this is yet another example of why the hell would you want to be an engineer in Formula One when you're never allowed the latitude to exercise your craft.
Yep. Enter Adrian Newey and exit Adrian Newey.
Exactly. You know, Adrian Newey is the perfect case in point here. You know, they come up with these brilliant systems, and then you know the FIA comes along and says, "No, that's illegal. You can't use it." And you know, all of a sudden, you know, your 5 years worth of work has just been flushed down the toilet.
Yeah. So also in our motorsports unintelligible amalgamation of motorsports musings grab bag for this evening, we're going to jump into some NASCAR talk. Yes, NASCAR talk from us. Yeehaw. Up in the paddock. This is what we're designing.
New ground here.
I mean, not new ground. I mean, we mock NASCAR on a regular basis.
Well, mock but, it, yes. But you said well, talk about it.
There is much to mock.
Yeah, well, here's an interesting one. The top nine teams in NASCAR have formed a single entity to collaborate. It's called the Race Team Alliance. It was announced on Monday. They have a chairman, somebody that used to work with Michael Waltrip Racing, Rob Kaufman. Their goals, as stated by themselves, is to lower costs for NASCAR teams, creating one voice on issues facing the teams. Calling it a union would be incorrect, says Kaufman. A union would be for employees. The right way to characterize it would be a business alliance. Unions are about employees directly trying to negotiate something. The RTA is pooling together to look at things we can be doing better. No one is looking to start a fight or be controversial. They listed out things that they'd like to do with their Race Team Alliance. This Race Team Alliance, the nine top teams, it's the 25 most well-known drivers in NASCAR that are kind of in this Race Team Alliance. The interesting thing is they're saying we're looking to do economies of scale by like doing bulk hotel room booking to save money and various things like that. Do we see this going any further?
Well, it depends on whether they're looking at becoming FOTA or becoming CART.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that's the key question. If they're looking to become FOTA, that might be a good thing.
Yep.
If they're looking to take over the sport a la CART, we've seen this movie.
Yeah.
Well, the France family is not going to allow a group, whether it's team owners or drivers or whatever, usurp the France family position or try to even, you know, strengthen their position. Granted, this is not like what the drivers tried to pull at the first Talladega race back when, and no, we're not going to drive. This doesn't sound like that. This sounds like it's something that's really going to be beneficial to the teams that all operate under the umbrella of NASCAR. It's not really going to be anything for development of cars or sharing that sort of data, but consolidate other like expenses. Like you mentioned, things like hotel rooms, transportation expenses, and you know, maybe even sharing marketing resources and that sort of thing. Save a company a buck. If they save some money in the administration side, that's more money they can put into the race car or hire better drivers or better crew members, engineers, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see this going cartwards unless there were a big bone of contention. And at this point, I don't see a big bone of contention that the owners have with NASCAR.
Right. No, I agree. I think this does have more of a photo feel, and
yeah,
it could be good for the sport. You know, how much the manufacturers are able to kind of influence things through this group, through the teams that they support.
Yeah.
That'll be the real interesting thing, because of course the manufacturers aren't especially happy with current regulations.
Mm, true.
I mean, who runs a normally aspirated single point injection push rod V8.
Yeah. Look, we have injection via throttle body.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, look, welcome to the 1970s.
We have unleaded fuel.
Yeah.
Dude, like my first car. Yeah, cool. It's fuel injected via throttle body in my 1989 Nissan Pulsar that I had. I mean,
so you're light years ahead of me. I had the carbureted Mustang. Not the good one.
Right?
The poor beggar.
That's why a certain segment of fans continues to appreciate NASCAR, because they keep it old school.
Well, true. And I can appreciate
all those IndyCar fans. Oh. Go ahead.
You're talking about true old school, you know, take a look at the engines and how they're designed and manufactured for these racing engines. That's certainly not old school.
Well, no, if you really want to think about
just the injection part,
how things were run old school, if you want to say that, look at what Dodge was doing in the 70s with the Superbird. They were constructing a production car with an eye on the track. They said, we've got to make 150 of these ugly looking pieces of crap just so we can get one at Daytona and kick everyone's butt. And as soon as it did, all of a sudden came the sexiest car around. I don't buy this, we want to keep it old school. If you wanted to keep it old school, you'd still be pushing the edge, and manufacturers would still be allowed to bring some really far out type of designs to the track. And we'd be seeing these small run production vehicles so that they could call it a production car, a stock car. Nice. John, I'm not buying that. Instead of saying old school, I think what people are nostalgic for the tech of that era. And okay, fine. If that's your thing, go to a nostalgia drag. All right. Go to your local dirt track every Friday night. It's brilliant racing. But if you want the top level of motorsport and you want deep pocket money coming to it from the manufacturers, you've got to give them a reason. And nostalgia is not a reason.
Nostalgia is a good reason. I'm going to be digging into nostalgia this weekend. I believe that I'm going to be making it to Kokomo for Indiana Sprint Week. So I'm looking forward to that on Saturday night.
Nice.
Yes, very nice. Great racing at Kokomo. If anybody's in the area and hasn't seen a good sprint car race at Kokomo, you need to go. It's beautiful. Great racing. But anyway, speaking of NASCAR, we can get a little bit more into it. We've hinted at this, but Sage Karam, he visited Ganassi's NASCAR team last week.
Yeah, I don't know how much to
put
into that. I mean, he's been around their sports car team a lot as well, and I tell you what, I think I would see Karam in a sports car faster than I'd see him in a stock car. But I mean,
maybe
if it comes to, hey, you could either sit on the sidelines or you could drive this, what are you gonna do?
No, absolutely. I mean, here's the thing. If he could get a paying drive in NASCAR, that's a far, far better thing than sitting around hoping to get a ride in IndyCar that somebody might give you a dollar for.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and maybe just going out there, that's a good place to just go shopping sponsors in general.
Oh, indeed. Indeed.
Well, and Ganassi's a large organization. Just because he was at their NASCAR shop doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Exactly.
He could just be meeting with somebody in the more organization. And that's where they happen to be, to meet, you know?
The biggest reason I throw this up here is because we've been hearing rumors for a little while that Sage Karam's been talking stock car. So this just is one more piece in that rumor mill. Hopefully for all us Open Wheel fans' sakes, you know, that he gets a good ride in our next year. And if he doesn't, I wish him the best in getting a paying ride somewhere.
Absolutely.
Bound in a brand new series that hit the track for the first time for testing at Donington. Yes, we're talking about Formula E. They went out for their first full day of testing last week. They had a couple of days of testing and all kinds of fun stuff going on with these cars. I mean, gentlemen, it's a spec series. These cars, it's going to be interesting to see when they hit the track. I think it's September 13th in Beijing. Some interesting names we've been hearing tied. Mike Conway has been given a race seat at Dragon for Formula E. And so has, what's his name? Antonio Felix da Costa has also been named for Amlin Aguri alongside Catherine Legg. So, yeah. He's da Costa's a kind of a big name. He's been talked about with Red Bull for a while. He was talked about as a potential replacement for Mark Webber, or you know, just somebody moving his way up in through the Red Bull Toro Rosso feeder series. So some big names there. I mean, especially Mike Conway. This is in his wheelhouse because it's street course racing and it's not ovals. So good deal for that. Now beyond that, Scott Speed has been testing Andretti's Formula E car, and so has Jill DeFerrin. What in the world?
Oh, I like Jill DeFerrin. That would be interesting.
I like Jill DeFerrin a lot too, but I think this is just a hey, let's go out and drive it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a test. Well, how do you put it? I think it's more of a Jill, you're a good friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm guessing he doesn't have the same reaction time he used to.
Yeah. I think he's his comments, you know, being an ambassador and strong supporter of Formula E from day one, I've been very curious and interested in how an electric-powered racing car would behave and handle. So that, you know, it's not a race seat. It's not nothing like that. It was just a, hey, you know, let's give it a try. But Scott Speed, on the other hand, I think fits very well in that seat with Andretti. So,
yeah. They've been working well together so far with GRC. So
indeed, make seven up yours. The motorsports unintelligible amalgamation of motorsport musings tonight. The segment of the show is over. There was a lot to about because, well, we had a Formula One race to chat up in that segment. So moving on, let's jump into the IndyCar portion and we'll kick it off with talking about Pocono. First thing to talk about at Pocono was Jack Hawksworth had a rather nasty hit with the wall and ended up with a myocardial contusion. That was the first article I saw that referenced it that way and
ow.
Did some pretty poor reporting in that I have no clue what a myocardial contusion actually is. So I got out the good old Wikipedia and it said it's a heart bruise that basically comes about as it usually happens because of an auto accident. So
yeah,
so he got a heart bruise.
Your body stops, your heart doesn't.
Yes.
That it is a extremely serious condition. And I'm sure they were looking very, very closely at Mr. Hawksworth, making sure all the plumbing was still intact. This is how Princess Diana died, right? The plumbing did not stay intact. When I saw that phrase, I'm like, oh, holy crap. Thankfully, it does sound like everything's good. He was cleared for Iowa, right?
Yes, he has been cleared for Iowa. There was talk that part of the reason that he was not cleared to drive was because Herta's car couldn't drive. They didn't have enough parts and spares to get it back on track. Even if he was capable of driving, they did not get a replacement driver for the car, and during the race they were working on getting it prepped and ready for Iowa. So,
you know, I think it's just well that they didn't. I mean, because that is definitely not something. That's definitely not a type of injury that you want to take any chances with. you want to check that stuff out.
Yeah.
Well, he was actually in the hospital overnight.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a, you know, you're cleared. They made it. So if you're any time that you're going to have to be there overnight, you're probably going to take a little bit longer before you should get back in the car.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, to be honest, I really wouldn't mind seeing him set out Iowa. I know being a race car driver, he wants to be back in the car as soon as possible. But right. Man,
those G-forces on you.
I was going to say that is one seriously sketchy injury. And yeah, that's that should be putting a little bit of fear in you.
I heard from one source that his hit was measured around 100 G's.
Oof. Yeah, I heard
that. Yeah, that's actually what they got. They've actually got accelerometers on the cars now, kind of like F1 does. And they said, it was 100 G impact, even with the safer barrier.
Compare that to Kimi Raikkonen's hit this weekend. It was a 48G, 49G hit when he hit the wall at Silverstone. So just a big difference in severity of those accidents. But
very much so.
So moving into the race, let's talk about how the race went down. The pit window seemed to be about 30, 32 laps, somewhere in there, depending on if you're leading or following. Chevy seemed to have a little bit better fuel mileage this weekend, which was a bit different than at Houston. So that kind of played into all of the strategies. I believe Juan Pablo stayed out one or more laps longer than everyone else early in the race. Early in-car telemetry showed him lifting early and trying to stretch the tank as the race went on. So you can see that there's a little bit of strategies being played out, but Juan Pablo didn't lead the majority of the laps of the race. The guys who led the most laps were guys like Will Power, Elio Castroneves, and Tony Kanaan.
And I say that's why he was able to stay out a little bit longer. The draft there was huge.
Yeah.
And, so he, because of the draft, he was able to conserve that a little bit more fuel relative to the people who were having to work to punch their way through the air.
It was shortly after Kanaan took the lead. That was when they showed Montoya's in car, and they showed him lifting. They showed him lifting early. They said, because Power let him by and Montoya let Kanaan by. And it was pretty obvious. They're like, let him go out there. Let him go fast. We've got our pace. We're going to stay on our strategy.
Yeah. Oh, it was a bad day to be Andretti or in an Andretti car because Newgarden and Marco both had pit speed violations. Ryan Hunter-Reay had suspension problems that put him like 20 laps down. And then even Carlos Munoz, he almost got flagged for a jump on the one restart of the race after Graham Rahal's caution. So kind of a rough day for Andretti. And while I argued that they needed an A on the mid-season report, well, starting to sound like I'm arguing a poor case, I think.
Now, the one thing, I guess the saving grace, Newgarden actually came back. He improved 13 positions from starting and to finish 8th by the end of it all. So he at least had a little bit of a bounce back.
Yeah. Well, the early going was definitely dominated by Penske. You had Power and Montoya and Elio Castroneves running in the top three until Kanaan, he started to use some pit strategy to take the lead for a while by pitting a little bit before everybody else. Juan, Will, and Elio were content to sip fuel, which is understood. But Tony really wanted to push it and go as fast as he could. The problem with that was he was on a slightly alternate strategy, and even at the one restart of the race, he went off strategy with everybody else and didn't work out as he hoped. They were kind of guessing on pit strategy. They were kind of guessing, not on pit strategy, but on yellows. They were kind of guessing there was going to be another yellow, and they would come in and run hot the entire race, and it didn't work out.
Isn't that the usual thing? It's the, once you see one yellow, it's like yellows breed yellows, so they hope.
Yeah, and the funny thing is this race played out so much like Indy did this year. I mean, it was so similar. You had a massive long green flag run until Graham Rahal swapped ends on lap 158. You know, he had a possible engine seizure, may have been aggravated by a wall slap, a tank slapper earlier in the race when he snapped the rear tires into the wall. Not sure exactly. Did any of you hear anything further on what happened to Graham's car? Because it just seized and stopped going.
Motor failure is what I was hearing.
Yeah, that's what it looked like.
Yeah, I wonder if, yeah, that was compounded, like you said, about his tap against the wall, which was, no, that was a smack, yes. Not a tap.
Yeah.
It was not gentle by any means.
The restart after Graham's incident, you had Munoz getting a warning, like we talked about, for jumping the restart. Kanaan he was good on fuel with a little saving, while leaders needed to stop again. If he could have, because he had 40 laps to go, or 38 laps to go when they actually restarted, if he could have gotten a yellow and saved a little bit more, he could have come out and won this race. However, that didn't play into his hands the way he would have hoped. Newgarden was also playing a strategy very similar to Tony Kanaan's, and it was not working for him either, because after that lap 158 yellow, there were no more, and it went green flag the rest of the way, with guys coming in and just taking a sip of fuel at the closing stages of the race to stay as fast as possible. But unfortunately for Tony and for Newgarden and others, that strategy didn't play out well, and you had a mess for guys like Elio and Power and, well, Juan Pablo Montoya trying to pass each other. Yeah. So what did you think of Juan Pablo's pass on Will Power, where he took off his wing plate?
You know, we've seen this before on the high speeds. You know, it that timing has to be so perfect, and it's not easy to do. You get in that draft, and you know there isn't a whole lot of draft there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once you get in closer, it just sucks you right up into that other car real quick, especially as you start getting slower, right, or closer, and you got to snap over so quickly. And it's happened before, and thankfully it didn't take Will out or him out. It just knocked that end plate off, and they're able to continue going, which is again a testament to the strength of these vehicles, you know, and the design they've got. And you know, those people that complain about having bumpers on the cars, you know, you didn't end up with a puncture incident either. So you know, I think all's fair in what happened there. He would have gotten the pass whether he clipped him or not.
Yeah, well, true.
It surprised me that after he made the pass and the wing was broken, that he was able to not only just keep going, but he was able to lead and pull away with a damaged wing.
Yeah.
Well, okay, it was
the end plate, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was damaged, and the aero was compromised. There's no doubt about that. However, the degree to which it was compromised was pretty marginal. You know, that end plate is there to help abate. It's there to help improve the efficiency of that front plane, that front element. It's kind of like the little winglets that you see on your passenger jet. There to reduce that wingtip vortex that's generated.
Right, it's a vortice.
Which removes efficiency from the wing. And so, did it have a negative effect? Sure, it did. But you know, I don't think that it added enough drag to the car to have a distinctly measurable difference with a car that was already performing very, very well. Does that make sense?
Yep.
It wasn't an insurmountable handicap.
Yeah, we've seen similar things like this in the past on street courses, especially where they knock off a corner of that wing, and the next thing you know, they're going faster.
look at Bourdais at Houston last week with half of his wing gone, and he was still keeping up some.
So moving forward from that, we had Elio having to make pass on Will Power. And this created probably the most talked about incident of the race. Okay, walk me through it. Does anybody think that Will Power didn't deserve a penalty?
If you wanted, you couldn't have come up with a more clear-cut case of what blocking is right here. I mean, you could just use this film footage when you go to train new drivers. because this was textbook perfect. He was so in the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was blatantly obvious. He moves over preemptively, which is fine.
Right.
You can do a defensive move. Then Alio moves over, and then he reacts to that. Done. Sorry. Penalty. Out of there.
That penalty was so quick in coming out, too. It's exactly what, like you said, it's textbook. This is blocking.
Right.
You can't argue any way, any shape, any form, anything different. I mean, Will Power's response over the radio was rather interesting. You know, obviously he hadn't seen the footage yet, but over the radio he said, "I worked my tail end off for that effing Indy car."
When he saw the video, or when they showed him the video during a post-race interview,
yeah,
he really just kind of shut up at that point. He realized, I blocked.
Yeah,
he knew it was coming.
But he still tried to equivocate on it, saying, "Well, you know, I braked and I wasn't trying to hold up my teammate." And he kept saying little things like that. But really, dude.
First move was proactive. Second move was reactive.
Yeah,
again, textbook, and I'm glad that they took action.
Yeah.
I don't care if he's leader in the points or what.
How could they not? I mean,
yeah. What fun is that?
I don't know. With the NASCARism of IndyCar these days, they could have not.
Yeah.
But they chose to take action, which I totally support and am happy they did.
Yeah. Power's comment during the race, he worked his tail end off for that, you know. Effing IndyCar, seriously, come on. And Cindric's response over the radio was really simple. That's not doing us any good now, is it?
Yeah.
Get your head on straight and go. And here's really what Cindric need to say. You endangered your teammate's finish position. You endangered your finish position. You freaking moron, we're going to talk about this. Yeah. In his post-race comments, Will Power said, "I'm sure Townsend Bell and them up in the booth will have their say on it."
Yeah, they had their say at the time that he did it, too. So,
yeah, I mean, obviously, this is well, and then the closing stages of the broadcast, they threw up a little graphic that showed these are the things that Will Power's been penalized for this year.
Yeah.
Today, blocking, Texas, pit speed violation, Belle Isle, race 2, contact initiated by him, Indy 500, pit speed violation, Indy GP, hit his own pit equipment, and before that, what was it, St. Pete, where he destroyed somebody, where was it, he, was it Newgarden that he blew off the track? Who was it that he blew off the track?
I do not remember.
Anyway,
I've slept since then.
He had one very early in the season, and everybody started crying foul, you know, basically saying that, you know, he's got Verizon on the side of his car, so he's getting the soft calls.
Oh, that was when he was. Are you talking about when he hit Pagano?
Ah, yes, it was Pagano. You're right.
That was at Long Beach.
Yeah. So
the punt.
What makes it worse is it's your teammate.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
The fact that it was his teammate, I guess it's a little more understandable, certainly not any more acceptable if it was, you know, anybody else, but, you know, the fact that it's your own teammate.
And
blows my mind.
Even beyond that, you look at that list of penalties he's had and, you know, really, you know, two pit speed violations, hitting his own pit equipment. Really, he can't do anything about hitting his own pit equipment. It was in his way. He ran over the dang cord. It's just what it is. But the other things, they're all on him. And those are points that you've just thrown away.
Yep.
And that's been his motif. That's been his way of doing things.
Whether
you know,
whether it's team created or him doing it himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the rules. Here is plain as day. Every one of those incidents that happened with him there. And what's funny is how light they have been on him earlier in the season, yet he still continued, you know, when he punted people, yet he still continued to make his own mistakes, the pit speed violations, running over the, you know, the hoses and things like that. And that's just the brakes, man. You got everybody else has those same rules. That one there is not something that you can, you know, isn't a judgment call. It is black and white.
Now, so moving on from that incident, because we're all in agreement, there's really nothing else to say. if the Yellows had went TK or New Garden's way, they may have been in victory lane. However, TK tried to stretch about 35 laps on a fuel run, and the best he had done up to that point was around 30. So clearly it's not going to happen unless he leaned it way back. And even slowing to less than 200 miles an hour for laps, he couldn't make a fuel target. So he ended up...
He was going scarily slow for a while there. Holy crap.
Yeah, he ended up dropping out with 3 laps to go and getting fuel. Newgarden dropped with 6 laps to go to get fuel. That left Juan Pablo Montoya in the lead, taking the win, his first IndyCar win in 14 years.
Now, what I have to say here, which is hilarious, is both you and John last week said, yeah, Juan Pablo win. Nope, he's not. Yeah, we're just, you know.
Oh,
you totally took it back. It's like, oh, you should have stayed with it.
Yeah. You know, I told a guy that I work with, I said, you know, I think Montoya is going to win this thing. See, I was even going back and forth after the podcast because I went and told him, told my friend at work, I think Juan Pablo is going to win it. So
I will say this, because Doug had other commitments while the race was going on. I was texting him updates, and I don't remember if it was at halfway or maybe about lap, about the time of the caution. And I flat out said him, I said, Power Montoya is going to win this.
Hmm. Yep. Yeah, I did. And I can tell you exactly when it was. It was when I was rolling through Columbia on my way home. So if you knew when I was rolling through Columbia, Missouri on my way home, you would have known exactly when John had told me that.
Wow.
Hey, don't laugh. If you've got access to the NSA, then
yeah, you too
can have that data.
Oh, they've got the they've got the Google Maps up. They're plotting it right now.
Oh, wow. So this ended up being the fastest 500-mile race on record. It ended up it ended up at a 202.4 mile per hour average. Wow. And that bested, this year's.
That's faster than an Indy, right?
Yeah. This year's Indy 500 was a 186, and it was the second fastest Indy ever, but it was the third fastest 500 mile race ever, which didn't come out until now because, well, stats, you don't bring them out. But anyway, so yeah, pretty cool to see that.
I got a little bit of a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Did this need to be 500 miles?
Well, if you're going to do the Triple Crown, which they were doing this year, then yes, it did. And I think it's appropriate for it to be 500 miles.
Did anybody else but me get a little bit bored?
No.
No.
Okay.
I was streaming the race at 1.5x speed.
Kind of like how Doug re-edits your podcast, right?
Nice, yeah. It was fantastic.
Well, keep it concise and I won't have to do that.
Especially, I guess maybe a third of the race, a third to a half of the race, right there in the beginning section, it became very apparent, at least up in the front, how the strategies were playing out and what was going to happen. So you could have turned it off maybe at about lap 60 or so, come back in about lap 120, and just
everything was the same.
You know, watch the end. Yeah.
Well, and the reason for that was, you know, everybody had their fuel targets, had their strategy in place, like you said. They're setting their, you know, their mixtures on the car, you know, and just making laps. Hitting the pit stops at exactly lap 30 or 32, whatever the hell it was, and then just going back out again. They're in the same spots they were when they started the previous 30 laps, and it got to be a little bit of a drone for me to watch for a little bit. There wasn't as much of the passing and excitement that I had seen in some of the other ovals, and
it was a little here's a difference harder to watch. Between Pocono and Indianapolis is that. You know, you can't pass as easily at Pocono.
Right.
It does take a little bit more planning and setup. And even though there wasn't, you know, as many overtakes, there was still just as much jockeying for position and, you know, playing the mind games and, you know, all that. I was still entertained by it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yesterday, I had to watch it on DVR. But anyway, I still found it a very enjoyable race, and enjoyed every lap of it. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, I understand how for some people, you know, they can say, well, this was boring. And, you know, for me, you know, I watch soccer, football, and, you know, at times I'm like, okay, they're kicking it this way. Okay, now they're kicking it that way. And it's because I don't understand as deeply some of the nuances of position and what's happening away from the ball as some other people do. It's like when I watch basketball versus my wife watching basketball, we both love it. But I'm more in tune with, you know, where the positioning the people are and, you know, some of the more nuanced aspects of the plays. And for me watching Pocono, I enjoyed the gambit of, you know, especially as they came down the front stretch. You saw a lot of people trying a lot of different positions. Some trying many positions all at once, and hence why Will Power got a penalty. But no, I enjoyed the race, and I'm glad it was a 500 miler.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on some of that stuff. You know, I guess what this actually showed to me also is the strength of the engines and the platform, you know, to handle that and pretty much zero attrition, other than you know, early on the suspension issue and what happened with Graham Rahal.
And Huertas had a
he
lost drive at some point. And that was the weird one because he pulled off into pit lane off on the right hand side, right beneath the
right.
Tower.
Yeah.
Well,
why are you stopping there?
I didn't fault him for that because, you know, I'm looking at that thinking, all right, oh, that's a safe place to be. You're not going to be in anyone's way diving for their for their pit box or anything like that.
Yeah. I don't
and,
think
you know, they say, well, there's some
him,
gaps,
right.
But you don't know exactly where those are. You know where your pit box is. And that's
right.
So,
you don't know if you're going to end up blocking somebody else's pit. And
right.
That's the last thing you want to do.
I'm okay with how he pulled off there.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody was faulting him with it necessarily, just wondering why he was stopping where he was stopping. With everything else happening around him, it was tough to stay focused on it and find that thing out and tell you about it on TV at least. So.
Right. Yeah, you know, up in the tower, you have the advantage of being able to look casually down. So, oh, there's an open spot right there. you know, from the cockpit, you don't have that luxury.
Right.
Well, so JPM ends up pulling this thing off, and I'll tell you, pretty impressed, especially with the final results of the race, because, you know, let's talk about the results a little bit. Montoya wins. Castro Neves ended up finishing second. Carlos Munoz ended up having a good day for his Andretti team, finishing in third. He was strongest in qualifying, strongest in the race for his
Banner
team.
Day for Andretti.
Yeah. Ryan Briscoe ended up finishing fourth, Scott Dixon fifth. Hey, that's about the best he's done this year. Well, somewhere in that area. Simon Pagenaud sixth, Mikhail Elation seventh. Wow. Joseph Newgarden eighth, Marco Andretti ninth, Will Power 10th, Tony Kanaan 11th, and that is the end of the lead lap. So while all these strategies were playing out and we were talking about, you know, the long green flag run and setting up and all that was going on there, one of the things that definitely was going on in the first 100 and so laps was everybody was just playing very conservative. They weren't, you know, trying to destroy the equipment. They were in for the long haul for the 500 miles. They had the similar aero package they had at Indy, and they were used to it. So therefore, they raced conservatively and saved it for the end and hoped to stay on the lead lap until the end. And majority of the people on that lead lap had a chance at the end because of that one last caution by Graham Rahal. So as far as the standings after this race, this is the big one, guys. Will Power, in his wisdom to make that block, it took him from the points lead and sole possession of the points lead to having Elio now tied with him for first and second. And now his teammate, Juan Pablo Montoya, who has been coming on strong the last few weeks, is now in fourth in the championship with 391 points. So he is back by about 50 points-ish. Somebody do the math for me so I don't have to. What, 45 points back?
I left my slide rule at the office.
Good man. Simon Pagenaud is still in there at 402 points, so he is also in there in this whole championship struggle. But, you know, it's getting interesting. Ryan Hunter-Reay can't be considered out of it at 388 points, though he's got a long way to go. You've got these double points weekends coming up at Fontana, and you've got a double points weekend still coming up at Toronto, so there's a lot that can change.
We got the title fight, boys.
Indeed, something worth watching. You know, all these double points races to end the season. It makes me feel like I'm watching Formula One, but you know.
Although three of the top four are Penske, I think that speaks volumes.
That does. It does. I think having Juan Pablo Montoya come to the team has really raised the game of the team. I also think that Willpower is going to continue to feel pressure and make boneheaded mistakes because that's what he's proven he can do.
So in 2015, is Juan Pablo the number one driver?
In 2015, yeah, I think he is. I think he definitely is, especially with the strength that he's shown this year.
Until they bring on Pagenaud.
Well, that's the other thing, gentlemen.
Well, Pagenaud. I don't think Pagenaud is going to Penske. I think he's going to Andretti.
Andretti? Yeah, I think Andretti would be a good fit for him anyway.
Well, Andretti's certainly the team that's made the most noise about wanting him, but that could be because they're competing with somebody else for the contract, and whether that be Ganassi or Penske or what. But so what about the race attendance? We could tell that the place was just packed with IndyCar fans, right?
Yeah.
Smattering I saw down near on the front stretch there.
Yeah.
It depends on where the front stretch. You have to figure that grandstand is freaking huge.
Yeah.
And when you get up close to the start finish line, there were more fans there. It looked like maybe 50% full. But you get out closer towards turn three or turn one, out toward the end of the grandstands, and there were hardly anybody in that in those sections. So
yeah, estimates by the local media said about 20,000. Kurt Cavan said he estimates around 15,000. So, you know, somewhere in that range. Grandstands can fit 76,000. They had probably about a little less than 30,000 last year for this race. So that's the real bugaboo, the real question, because the
Igdalski is not happy, let's just put it that way.
Yes, and here's the big reason, gentlemen. This was ideal conditions. You had a perfect weekend. I mean, it was just immaculate here in this area of the country, even though I'm, you know, a few hours to the west of said racetrack. It was perfect weather, just gorgeous, nice and temperate weather, and there is no reason people wouldn't be coming out to the track except, hey, spending time with your family on 4th of July weekend. So there's question is 4th of July a good thing, a good weekend to have this race?
No.
Probably not.
Well, I mean, look really at Watkins Glen.
Yeah.
I mean that was a 4th of July. Pardon me. That was a 4th of July weekend race as well. And it, not only was it hard to get fans there, it was hard to get business there. You know, you think about the business stuff, the hospitality stuff, that really, since the TV numbers just aren't there, that has to be a big part of your sponsorship package. That bring your clients out to the track, wine them, dine them, you know, watching race cars instead of on a golf course. And you know, you just don't want to do that on 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, I think it'd be best in IndyCar's long term interest to skip 4th of July weekend.
Yep.
Especially since so much of your activation, like you said, of your activation of your sponsors happens at the track. You know, I remember a few years ago, Andretti was talking, and he said that when they go to present to potential sponsors, they don't even include the TV.
Why would you?
Part of the package, because the TV numbers are just atrocious.
Yeah, it's you know, don't bring up the parts of your package that suck. You know, don't shoot yourself in the foot. And so you highlight the things that are shiny and that can be awesome. And you know, TV isn't that.
Yeah, unfortunately. But, you know, the attendance number of 20,000 was mocked a bit in the media. 15,000 probably is closer to the truth. In grandstands, it could fit 76-some thousand. It looked bad, and the track was unhappy, and it's talking about getting out of their last year of the contract just because last year barely broke even, and they were hoping for better this year, and they got much, much worse.
Yeah.
So,
do you remember Kansas in 2010?
Oh, yes.
That's what this really feels like.
Milwaukee.
Oh,
jeez. It wasn't that.
Here's something, though. Obviously, nobody was in the stands because the people that you want to draw to the stands either didn't know about it or weren't going to go there from the for the holiday weekend. When I made my epic road trip, we drove right through that part of the country twice. Mm-hmm. You know how much external anything I had about either Pocono Speedway or the IndyCar event?
No.
Guesses? Anybody?
Nothing.
Zip. Nothing.
Yeah, and that's that's what a typical IndyCar media market looks like when you go in to see a race. I've just been saddened when I go to see a race anywhere with IndyCar, and I just see nothing about the race anywhere around. I mean,
and coming, but you know, when we were coming across, along Lake Erie, you know, we drove past Watkins Glen that section of New York, and there were billboards promoting events at Watkins Glen. One of the NASCAR events was one of the big things, obviously. People are going to recognize that. They're promoting that, you know, those events are getting promoted, whereas the events at Pocono were not. Now, to be fair, there was no promotion or no indication of any of the cup races at Pocono either. There was just, it was like a big void. And I was just kind of, curious because I was driving through there. Hey, I know there's a racetrack over there, but I don't see anything about it, you know, which is kind of sad.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think about the Mid-Ohio race. I don't see anything in the local media here in Columbus about it. Of course, I'm an hour away from the track, but, driving up to the track, I don't see any billboards. I don't see any signs. I don't see anything that would indicate other than maybe a flashing sign out by the highway that says race traffic, use these exits.
Now here in Houston, for about a month leading up to the race, there was signage, billboards, and that sort of thing, at least here locally. I see billboards for the events out at Circuit of the Americas in Austin, which is 3 hours away, too.
Well,
good job.
Yeah, IndyCar has all kinds of strange things that they need to deal with, and one of those is the whole Panther situation. The lawsuit that John Barnes filed against IndyCar and packaging brokers and the Indy Racing League and Ray Hall Letterman and one defendant in particular, I can't remember his name, but one person in particular, it's Metzler.
Argent Metzler.
Yes, who worked for the U.S. government. Apparently, the U.S. government has said you can't sue an individual. You are suing the U.S. government. So they've kind of changed the briefs, and they are now suing the U.S. government instead of Metzler. A little different situation there.
Well, you know, if who has deeper pockets.
Right.
Well, that's
but awesome. Hey, if businesses are people too now, then so is the U.S. government, right?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. I mean, let's see. Dallara is working on a suspension fix for Toronto. If you recall, Will Power, I believe it was Will Power, who had suspension failure in the closing stages of the second Houston race. It came down to shims in the camber adjustment system for the car, and one of the issues is these shims are little C-shaped shims that go into it, and then you tighten down the camber adjustment, and then if you want more camber, you put in more shims. You want less camber, you put in less shims, what have you. The problem is those shims are popping out, and this is the third incident of this season where it has ruined somebody's race. So, yeah, for Toronto, they're looking at fixing said problem with the shims. Yeah. Yeah, just needs to be, you know, the biggest reason that this is brought up is that the teams are a little bit annoyed because they would have fixed this already were they allowed to make components for their cars, but they're not. It's Dallara approved stuff, Dallara price tags on them.
See
but,
previous yeah. conversation regarding engineers
right.
and engineering craft.
Yeah. So IndyCar is planning a penalty system change, and I did not dig up this article, so I'll let the suspect who did talk about it.
What am I, suspect now?
Yes, indeed.
Basically, they're Derek Walker. They're looking into procedures for investigating post-race penalties. It comes about after Bourdais. He was fined for the incident with Wilson at Texas Motor Speedway, and then the penalty then was rescinded because there wasn't sufficient evidence. So they want to avoid having egg on their faces or putting out the wrong call initially, I think is what they want to prevent. So whether it's going to prevent that, I don't know. I think you're always going to have those kind of situations where it's a judgment call, and sometimes your judgment isn't the best at the time, and you have to deal with that. So we'll see. I don't see how much they can do differently, or maybe some things better, but it doesn't say what they're going to do.
Okay. Well, that pretty much wraps up the IndyCar section, except Iowa is this coming weekend. So who's going to win at Iowa? And if you pick somebody other than an Andretti driver, I'm going to say try again.
You don't think Kanaan could do it?
Maybe, but I'm thinking Andretti owns that track. So I'm going with Newgarden.
Oh, there we go. Newgarden, that'd be awesome.
So we got an Ed, we got a Newgarden. Anyone else want to throw out their potentials?
I'm
20-sided die.
I'm gonna stick with TK.
Nice.
Wow.
As long as he doesn't get hit by that bump in between turn 1 and 2, their tunnel.
Well, I know who will definitely hit that and have something break. It's got to be Graham Rahal.
Yeah. And I'm bummed about not getting to go again this year. I'm going to be at Heartland Park Topeka, competing both Saturday and Sunday.
Very cool.
Yeah, so let's see. Photograph motor racing or do motor racing? I chose to do motor car racing.
That's all good. Mr. Shaw, to your 20-sided die point, I've got multiple of those floating around my house. So.
Yup.
I have issues.
I have them too.
Okay, so next year when we meet for the hill climb, there's going to be a pen and paper night.
Nice.
Oh, sad.
Oh boy.
I can see how this is a blendification of our hobbies. Okay, tonight you're Tony Kanaan, and you need to make a saving throw against oil spill.
I rolled a one.
Oh my god!
Critical fail.
Wow. I think we have now lost about half our audience.
or completely solidified their allegiance.
Right.
It worked pretty much that way.
What was that, John?
There was an old tabletop board game that was racing.
Oh yeah,
I forget the name of it. But it worked pretty much that way. Okay, it wasn't exactly saving throws, but
your dice rolls.
Yeah, determine how far you win when certain things happen.
What was the name of that? I remember that. I can see
Formula Day or Formula D is the newest version of it. I have it sitting on my shelf. It's a lovely game.
Nice.
Actually, what I found funny was I was in a game store a few weeks ago, and they had the newest track pack from Formula Day Formula D. And the two tracks on it, which I laughed about because one of them was the new Russian track.
Oh.
The other one was the New Jersey Grand Prix. And at the time, it was all this going on with Ukraine, and I looked at it and I was like, neither of these are tracks.
That's not going to happen.
Anyway, well, let's move on then, unless Mike wants to elaborate on what his 20-sided dice reveals.
I think I'm going to be with you on Newgarden.
Okay, we got a new guard, and nobody's taking Ryan Hunter Ray. That'd be a good one as well. But, yeah, Marco always has a chance to fail dramatically, but we'll see. Let's move on to the Road to Indy portion of the show, and I'm going to let Mr. Doug Patterson take it away and tell us all the scintillating details of the, you know, cars on track.
The last race was at Indianapolis, and Chavez makes up for a disastrous pair of races in the Grand Prix, and both he and Beach had some issues during the Grand Prix and allowed the rest of the field to kind of catch up to them. Chavez ends up taking the Freedom 100, and that put him in a tie with Beach going to Pocono. It was a dead heat. And so this was really a critical race for both of them. Veach scored first blood by winning the pole, taking that crucial extra bonus point for winning the pole. And he used that to great effect for the first few laps. Luis Razia, he had a fantastic start. And got around Beach on the low side going in turn one, but couldn't hold it in the stretch between between one and two where Beach overtook him on exit and then kept the lead, started to stretch it out, and looked like he was far enough away that there really was just no way that anyone's going to get enough of a draft to catch him. The draft was huge, and you know, it was amazing how much you could make up, how much distance you can make up if you had a really good draft. But the issue was Beach was just too far ahead, and when we thought, you know, this is it, you know, Beach is gone, he's going to take the lead, and then all of a sudden there's Rossi right on his gearbox. And it's challenging for the lead again, trying to make paths. What had happened is Beach made he missed a shift or shifted at the wrong time. He hit the limiter and it just killed his momentum. That singular mistake, that one mistake, cost him 22 points. It was a 22-point swing between how it could have gone down and how it eventually did go down. While he and Razia were fighting, Chavez just cruises by both of them, says, thank you, and is gone. He's gone, daddy gone. The race wasn't completely over at that point. Razia, you know, as they came back around, he was fighting with, I believe he was still fighting with Veach for P2, but he ended up getting down low on the track and put the left side tires down onto the apron and really unsettled the car, and he hooked it right into the inside wall, bringing out the only caution of the race. And in the restart, Veach tried to pull the same maneuver on Chavez that Razia had pulled on him at the beginning of the race, but had similar results. That is, he got ahead of Chavez in turn one, but Chavez retook the lead and then kept it for the remainder of the race. And, you know, to pull a Marty Reed-ism, they ran in lockstep for the remainder of the race. It was Chavez, Veach, and Jack Harvey, who had a very fine race. You know, we're used to seeing the Schmidt guys up front, and the two Schmidt, you know, the strong drivers there at Schmidt, Razia and Harvey, they're still trying to wrap their heads around ovals, and they're doing a good job. But you know, you're looking at two veterans of the series and two drivers with some good oval experience now in Veach and Chavez, and they just ran off with it. But yeah, that one little shift by Veach, that cost him the race. It cost him the lead, and now Chavez will go to I believe their next race is Toronto. They'll go to Toronto with Chavez having an 11-point lead over Veach. So It was a good battle in the first half of the race. The second half of the race was Mr. Shaw, it's as you were pointing out with the IndyCar race, there just wasn't a lot of action, and in this case, there wasn't even a lot of jockeying for position and all the nuances. It was just that was it. You know, they ran where they ran. You know, the sad thing about this race though is that you know, the battle for the lead, you know, for the front position between Harvey and Razia and Chavez Beach, that was half the grid. There was a total of 8 cars.
Ouch.
8 cars on track for the Indy Lights race at Pocono. Zach Meyer of Team Moore Racing. I always have to stop and think of whether teams are racing, autosport, motorsport. But anyway, Team Moore Racing, TMR. There, Zach Meyer said, I'm not going to do this. Personal reasons, and he did this on race day morning.
Oh,
really? Alex Barron did not race with Berlardi. And so they're down to one car. That means that, you know, you have the four machines from Schmidt-Peterson with Razia, Harvey, Petrohita, and Garcia. And then you had Chavez with Berlardi, and you had Veach and Brabham with Andretti Autosport, and Scott Anderson with Fan Force United, who's announced that they're going to be running in IndyCar next year as well. Stefan Wilson is going to drive.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so, I heard about that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But anyway, so 8 cars. Man, this is not good. You know, I have some genuine concerns about 2015. But
when is the new chassis coming out?
Next year.
Yeah. Well, so, and
that might draw in more people. So
we'll talk about later.
We're hoping.
Yeah,
we'll
that's
talk
the hope.
About this
right?
Later. I don't want to get into it now.
Well, it just put it this way: having a new chassis can reinvigorate interest in the series and bring people to the series that weren't considering it because the equipment was so out of date. The other thing it can do is take people who are in the series
because they're going to have to buy new equipment.
It's going to cost more money to continue in a series that maybe they're not seeing the financial benefit of.
And you know, this is something that we'll talk about later in the season and more in the off season. But
yeah,
it's something we'll keep our fingers on the pulse of, and I'll continue to talk to some people, kind of see where things are going. But I'm uncomfortable with what I'm hearing so far. One positive thing is that Peter Portante did a test in the Brian Herta Autosport Indy Lights car this week.
Where did they do that test? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm sure it was at Putnam Park.
That's my guess, but
I have that supposition. I have no data. It's always good to have a test. It's always good to hear that Brian Herta Autosport is still thinking about participating in Indy Lights, even though of course they weren't at Pocono, not in Indy Lights anyway. But anyway, so we'll keep tabs on that. I'll try to see if we can get Peter back on the show sometime. But anyway, that's all I have for the Monster Road to Indy.
Good deal. Well, we'll move on to the last segment of the show tonight, and Mr. Shaw is going to lead us through the latest in the World Rally Championship and other spots rally-ish
related.
Yes, thank you for finishing my sentence. I paused to take a drink of my beer.
It's all good. You know, yeah, not a lot of rally news in this last week. Obviously, there was, you know, a lot going on last week, the week before, when I was absent from the show. But, you know, it was my wife's birthday, and sometimes you know, got to make sure that you take care of the wife and don't do your podcast on her birthday. Probably not the greatest thing. So anyway, so the latest news going on right now with the WRC is that Citroën M-Sport, they're planning on some changes to their cars for 2015, which is hopeful because VW is just kind of running away with it. There have been a couple of times that they've been, you know, close to the pace, but it's not just the drivers here. The car is appears to be superior to the both the Citroen and the M Sport Ford Fiesta. So no specifics on what changes they're going to do, but both Malcolm Wilson and Citroen have stated that they've got some major design changes coming up. Citroen said in three specific areas, so engine, aero, and suspension, which is pretty much everything.
What else is there?
Right, exactly, right? He's <mean, laughs> like, in three major areas. Well, that's everything.
Yeah.
Because that's the three I would pick, you know, in three areas. That is all three. Anyway, except for maybe brakes. Okay, fine. There's your fourth. But anyhow, I'm excited that they're, you know, this is the, both of them have said that this will be the biggest change that they've done since they introduced these new cars in 2011. Okay, so so it sounds like more major changes versus little minor tweaks, supposedly. We'll see how it transposes in the 2015 season. M Sport said their changes probably won't show up, though, until about the third or fourth round of next year. But it sounds like Malcolm is committed to the 2015 season, but he's still out there searching for sponsors to help him out, too. Mm. I'm sure he'd like to not be just M Sport anymore and get Ford on board. But, you know, that's going to depend a little bit more on how the TV product ends up. You know, whether they do make these changes that they've been talking about with the shootout or whatever. So, sucks that Ford is just kind of staying on the fence right now, but, you know, at least they still got the cars out there. Hyundai announced a little bit of a change coming up. Well, not really a change, but an addition. For the tarmac rounds, at least for Germany coming up, be in August, they're going to bring on Brian Bouffier as their third driver. So you still got Danny Sordo, who's going to be their tarmac driver, to go alongside their principal driver, Thierry Neuville. But they're going to bring on Brian Bouffier as their third driver. You know, Brian Bouffier was one of their test drivers throughout the last year in 2013, when they were just kind of doing some test drives with the car. He deserves a shot. You know, the only time he's actually driven the full WRC spec was in a regional rally with French Championship, and he ended up actually winning that event. So it'll be good to see him out there on a full WRC event for the team, because he's actually done a lot to help them out. As much as I like seeing Hayden Padden and some other drivers like Juho Hannanen getting a shot at it too, there's a lot of good talent out there. Brian Bouffier is one of them, and it'll be nice to see how he does, especially how much he helped out with development in the tarmac development side of the car. So, other than that, really, we're just kind of waiting for the next round, which is WRC Finland. Bring on the Yumps. Yump. That's July 31st through August 3rd. So, still a little ways out. They got a little bit of a break right now. Although 81 crews are set up for that event, so far, 16 of which will be the WRC cars. So that's a pretty good, pretty busy schedule they're going to have ahead of them. It's a lot of entries. It's exciting to see this number of entries, you know, and obviously having, the four different manufacturers in there, just need it to be a little more popular with the TV. Mm. A little something I wanted to kind of do a little talk about was when you guys were talking about the hill climbs from 2 weeks ago, which was awesome, having both Pikes Peak and then you had the Mount Washington hill climb, of which another record was broken. There was also another hill climb going on at the same time. In Great Britain, they have the what I think is honestly the greatest celebration of motorsports in the world, the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Have any of you guys ever watched coverage of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, there are a few motorsport events that are on my bucket list. You know, I want to go to Spa sometime, and I want to go to Le Mans, and I want to go to Goodwood. We're going to take care of Pikes Peak next year.
Yeah, you know, Goodwood is, you know, it isn't so much about just, you know, trying to get the fastest time to the top of the hill.
It's a celebration of motor racing and of cars.
And, you know,
nothing like seeing Ken Block hoon through the nice manicured lawns of the lordly estate.
In a lawnmower.
Well, he did that a few years back. They, yeah. No, yep. Actually, at Goodwood, he ended up hooning through the yard as part of the exposition. So that was 2 or 3 years ago. I can't remember for sure, but
I approve.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, I think it was just a couple of years ago. He was excited to be there, and it was on his bucket list as well. For those of you that don't know Goodwood, I mean, it's this amazing spectacle of celebration of motorsports, everything from motorcycles to sports cars to Formula One to rally. They set up a little rally stage on the backside of this hillside. There's this, it's Lord March's Goodwood mansion, you know, that's there on top of the hill. And there's a hill climb event that's 1.2 miles, I think it is, something like that, that kind of goes up past the mansion slash castle, if you want to call it that, you know, and then goes down a little ways to a finish. And there is currently a record there of 41 seconds, I think it is. And this year was interesting because the Pikes Peak hill climb, Peugeot 208 T16 Pikes Peak, that Sebastian Loeb drove to glorious victory at Pikes Peak, was there for the first time, and it was set to run a time there. It unfortunately did not end up getting the fastest time there. Afterwards, they said that there was a gearing ratio, that the gears were a little bit too long, and he needed a shorter ratio to be able to get it up to be able to go that short route. And get the fastest time. So he did it in, Sebastian Loeb was there, and he did it in something like 45 seconds, if I remember correctly. So he was the fastest of the day, 45.82 seconds, that's what it was. He was faster than a McLaren F1 GTR Longtail that Kenny Brack drove, which was 47.92 seconds. Yeah. And what was really interesting also there is there's this young kid driver. I don't know if you ever heard about him. He's doing sports car racing these days. He's Nissan. His name's Jan like Martinborough, and he did a time of 48.05 seconds. He was a gamer. He played at this competition through Gran Turismo. And nice. With a combination, I think it was Nissan had this sponsorship thing that if you win, you know, this championship thing they did online with Gran Turismo, you'd actually get be able to do like a time attack, some training and a time attack drive in one of their cars. He won that, and now he's actually a team driver. He's that good.
Nice.
So, and that kid did it in 48.05 seconds coming up the hill with his first time. I can't remember what car it was that he drove, but holy crap, dude. Going from gaming to going to Goodwood and going up there in 48 seconds.
See, and I think that that's a great basis for training our future generations of starfighter pilots.
You think we don't?
That is a great movie. Love that movie.
I'm serious. You think we don't?
That is awesome.
I've been in one of the FA-18 simulators, and yep. I tell you what, you know, it reminded me a lot of the Jane's U.S. Naval Fighters that I played back in the 90s.
There you go.
I played those like, too.
I've seen this before. I know how to do this.
Falcon 3, how many of you played that?
Was
18 floppies?
Yeah.
Was there a button to initiate the Death Blossom?
No, there wasn't. But I did come very, very, very close to being successful in my first carrier landing. I missed the number 4 wire by just a margin.
Call the ball.
And yeah, I did. You know, full afterburner, got it back up, you know, into the air. We just ran out of time for me to circle back around and have another go at it. But you know, no. In all seriousness, simulators have gotten so good. You know, the physics that we're able to put into games and simulation technology is it really astounds a lot of people who aren't familiar with with the industry and really what's happening. It is amazing, and it doesn't surprise me at all that someone, especially playing Gran Turismo, with a proper set of wheels, pedals, and all, could get in a car and be quick, be as competitive as a professional level driver. No, but you know, it's, you know, you see the same thing in poker. You know, the fact these simulators are so good allows these kids to get so much seat time and so much experience with so many different tracks and situations at a much faster rate than what some of the old school drivers had to do. And you think how long they had between opportunities to get seat time. Just like, you know, the old poker players having to grind out, you know, in smoky rooms running at, you know, 20 hands an hour or something like that. And these kids are doing 60 hands an hour on multiple boards.
I'll give you a little bit maybe on the reaction time from that. But I think what's still different though is what plays in a big factor is the feel. I think it's really the technology of force feedback and stuff like that that kind of gets into there. And these guys knowing where the limits are, mm-hmm. Using the simulators, also knowing the details of the track. Mm-hmm. This is what goes beyond, you know, I guess the poker analogy.
Right.
You know, they'll know where every little bump is, where they're going to have to lift just a little bit. You know, provided the performance of the simulator is similar to stand-up driving. And then once they get out there, you know, yeah, they could probably make a little bit of show of it. And that's why some of the professionals also use simulators.
Absolutely.
If not so much to, you know, set up the car, then at least to know every single inch of that track.
Right. Familiarize them with track so they could. It's not even a thought process anymore.
And these tracks with some of these games out there, I know we're going off topic just a little bit, but they're laser scanned.
Oh, yeah.
No joke. They go out there with a truck with laser beams. That's as they drive across the track, it's measuring the depth of every single bump and groove on that track.
Well, let me give you an example. Of course, in Gran Turismo 5, they had the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, right? If they mm-hmm. went out and measured in just immense detail. And it's cool driving around real slow, looking around. Oh yeah, and you know you recognize all these things. And got to go on a pace car ride with Philip Major was our driver. And all the way around, he's you know this was my my buddy Phil and I and some other person that got stuck with us. And we're all geeking out on turn in points and all that and Major is talking to us and one thing I remember is turn in point for turn four, there's a silver or you know there's a metal access door there in the north chute wall. And he says, when you see that, right as you hit that, that's your turn in. And Philip and I, when we got back, we're playing it. It's like, oh, be damned, he's right. It works perfect. And, you know, so, you know, you're right. The accuracy with which they can render and model these tracks is like no other. And, you know, it's not like, you know, back in the day with pole position, right?
Right.
You know,
well, you have tire degradation they put in there. They put in all kinds of stuff. So.
There's genuine skill that you can extract. Not to say that it's a replacement for genuine seat time in a real racing machine.
No, you'll never get G-forces.
No, but you know, that is to say that some of them couldn't come in and make a fair showing.
Yep. So, you know, getting back to the Goodwood Festival of Speed, what I personally find so great about the Goodwood Festival of Speed is, quite honestly, just the sound of hearing these historic cars. You know, and they got the modern cars as well, but it's these historics, hearing them fire them up and go up that hill. These are cars that normally you just see on some, you know, old video, you know, you might find on YouTube or something like that. It's all like sound quality's crap, you know, back because recording quality wasn't so good back then. Or it's something you'd see as a museum piece and it would just be sitting there. Wow, that thing is so cool. Wonder what it used to sound like. Mm-hmm. At Goodwood, they drive them. They run them up. They're not going to run them at the top, of course. You know, that's you know, on their limit. But they're driving them. You can hear them. They're on song, and it just really takes you back.
And this is such a great thing. This is the huge attraction to vintage racing, and you know, Goodwood is a celebration of that. I would love to have been at the vintage race at IMS. That from everything I heard was a magnificent event. But you know, vintage racers. You know, it's not like these car show people who a lot of times will push their car into a trailer, roll them out gently onto a carpet for the show, right? And then push them back onto the trailer. You know, they don't want to start it because they don't want to discolor the shiny exhaust. You know, the vintage racers are like, no, this is a race machine. I'm going to bloody well race it. And they race them at, you know, at the limit and wheel to wheel. And it's magnificent to see machines well cared for, but also doing what they were built to do.
Agreed.
You know, and that's not sitting in a museum. That is running under full song.
The flip side to that is when there is an incident and one of those cars gets wadded up, it makes you weep.
It does. It's gut-wrenching and heartbreaking. But at the same time, you wouldn't have it any other way. You wouldn't have had them stay home because of the risk.
You know, this is the same thing that actually Chuck Yeager has talked about with people that own P-51 Mustangs.
Yeah.
Was a commemorative Air Force, which has B-29s and B-17s that they still fly around the world, around the country.
Put them in the air.
And they're saying that, you know, one of his things is, you know, we need to preserve these things and we should just, you know, lock them up somewhere. But keeping them locked away, these fabulous machines, it's that sound, it's that experience of seeing them in the air. That is the life of these machines.
Yep.
Having them locked up in a museum somewhere. Okay, yes, I can understand your concern about one getting wadded up, crashing, whatever. And yes, you do weep for that. But these were meant to be run.
Yeah. And that's what makes Goodwood so cool, is that you do get to see these old racing machines actually be driven and raced up the hill. And it's just so cool.
And similar to every year when you go to the 500 and they run some of the vintage cars around the track. And
oh, yes.
Every now and then you see that Marmon Wasp out there. And here's the dirty little secret, or the clean little secret. That thing's going around there with the same fluids that it raced in.
It has
the same. They extract they drain the engine of all the fluids. They preserve the fluids, and then they come out there and put those fluids in and run that thing around the track with the same fluids that it raced 100 years ago.
Now, how magnificent is that?
Yes,
that is awesome.
Yeah, that.
Oh,
that's,
wow.
That has to be the most well preserved car on the planet.
If you ever get the opportunity to come down to Barber Motorsports Park, you have to make a trip through the museum.
That's why I want to go to Barber.
If for no other reason than I believe there are three pieces in the museum that are not in running condition or could be brought up to running condition very, very quickly. And there are race cars, very rare. It's the largest private collection of Lotus outside of Lotus themselves, both race cars and road cars, as well as a lot of motorcycles from around the turn of the century, turn of the 19th century. I'm sorry, turn of the 20th century.
Late 1800s, early 1900s.
I mean, they have steam-powered motorcycles. And they can just, hey.
Gotta give it up for the external combustion engine.
Let's get it out on track. You know, they can crank it up and get it out on track however quickly, whatever prep time it takes to do that. I love the fact that everything there is drivable with, you know, barring a couple of exceptions.
My last little thing I can say about Goodwood is, you know, again, this is a celebration of motorsports, both new and old. And along with the new, you know, it was great to see them exemplify how the internet has changed motorsports over recent years. The entire coverage was streamed live globally for the first time, and it was free. Hello, Pike's Peak Hill Challenge. Hello. So they did a free streaming of that. They also recognized social media's big impact with motorsports over the last few years. So they added, you know, when they're interviewing drivers and whatnot, they'd ask questions from Twitter and whatnot, from, you know, people that tweet questions worldwide and whatnot. So it was really kind of neat to see that being a big part of it, because that has been how motorsports has started to change over the years. What's really cool is if you missed the Goodwood coverage, You can replay it anytime you want. You've got a YouTube channel. The link's up on our website. I posted just about an hour ago an article. And what's awesome is they had like 10 hours of coverage with each full day. There's 3.5 days of it. So it's like 4 hours the first day, then 10 hours, 10 hours, and 10 hours for each one of the days, showing all the coverage of all the cool cars, interviews with legends, Emerson Fittipaldi, seeing him drive a 1970s era F1 car up the hill climb. You know, it's just a whole lot of awesome. So if you want to listen to some just beautiful engine sounds in the background and whatnot, go to our site, go to that link, and watch some of that Goodwood footage. It's pretty freaking cool. Moving on into other rally news, actual rally news, not rally-ish news, I guess, in this case. Subaru Motorsport decided they'd start doing a little bit more when it comes to the mobile world of things, and created a nifty new app showing, you know, obviously, David Higgins and Travis Pastrana with their rally racing that they do. Well, the neat thing about this nifty app that you have for both Android and iPhone is they add this nifty 360-degree viewing control for the video. So as they're going up Pikes Peak Hill or the Mount Washington Hill Climb, you can actually turn the camera and see how close to the apex they're getting while it's playing. It's really freaking neat. You can't adjust the tilt on it, so it's got a wide enough angle. So they somehow have this 360-degree constantly recording. You know, so maybe it's a set of, you know, four or five cameras, maybe statically set, you know, recording all the different angles there. And it's great. You just pivot, you know, you just move with your finger along the screen as it's playing, and it'll move the camera in that direction. And you can see just how well they're hitting those corners, or you can look behind them as the dirt flies and all that stuff. It's a pretty nifty concept there. Other than that, Rally America News, we're up next is going to be, it's not this coming week, but another week from now, is going to be the New England Forest Rally. You know, all your typical suspects will be there. We do not have, of course, Ken Block. He'll be, of course, missing that one. David Higgins, Travis Pastrana, of course. Not really anybody else to compete with those two, so it's all Subaru once again when it comes to the top teams in the open class. Of course, it'll be all about Dylan Van Way versus Nick Roberts when it comes to production. We do have Matt Johnson back with the Scion XD, so they finally fixed what broke in the engine on that. Hopefully they have a stronger transmission that kept breaking on that car. So they had gear issues as well, so they'll be able to hopefully eat with ACP a little bit more. Still got a couple weeks for that one to come up. Other than that, that's kind of it for rally news.
All right, well, that takes us to the closing of the show. Any saved rounds before we wrap this one up for the evening, gentlemen?
I have nothing.
Well, I was going to say maybe John's going to have to rename his The Missed Shift to the Zach Beach.
It was such a small bobble. I'm not going to throw him under the bus for that. It's just when the racing is that close.
Yeah.
You know,
any little blip.
Any little tiny little thing.
These guys are, well, if I remember right, I was watching a little clip from the Mazda Indy TV off YouTube, and these guys are just foot to the floor the whole way, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They are. Yeah, well, except at Pocono. You know,
I thought they were actually foot to the floor at Pocono is what they were saying.
Well, sort of, but depends on your gearing.
Gotcha.
And you know, you can have a couple of tall gears you can select between. At Pocono it's pretty close. They certainly won't be at Milwaukee.
Well, that will wrap up the Open Paddock podcast for this evening. So for J. Douglas Patterson, John C. Olsakowski, and Mike Shaw, I am Mike Weitzel, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. Good night.